Hello.
Good evening.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm late.
Oh, okay. It's okay. And to be clear, you were actually late. Not you weren't just sarcastically saying that to me. Just want
No,
everyone to know that.
I'm not doing a bit. No, it was actually late. No, it's my mom's fault. She thought 2 minutes before the show would be a good idea to a good time to have a phone call where it's just like, hey, what you doing? How's it going? Like, I literally can't talk right now. I have to go. Oh, okay, cool. What's going on? Like, no, seriously. Need to
Did
stop.
you tell your mom that you were gonna do your podcast with me?
Yeah, and then of course it's what's the movie tonight? It's like can we do this another time? Anyway, I'm here.
What's your mother's verdict on Trading Places?
I think she said okay or something like that when I mentioned the movie title. I don't think she has any idea what it is.
That's strange. I mean, it was a fairly popular film of the era.
So I don't know, did you have any whatever the terminology we're using now for business ahead of the movie is?
Well, earlier today, you had messaged a few people that you were disassembling and reassembling a stove to clean it thoroughly, and I just wanted to follow up on that and just ask you if you had put it back together.
Yeah, I did. I put it back together. It is functional. We made some pasta this evening. Nothing exploded, so that was good.
That's nice. Yeah, I had some zoodles. Yeah.
What'd you put? What'd you make with the like zucchini zoodles or?
Yeah, well, that's the only kind of zoodles there is.
I thought you could. I mean, you could technically use some other various squash type things, can't you?
Yeah, but then they're not. You wouldn't call them a zoodle, because
Hmm.
the zoodle nomenclature is reserved for zucchini noodles. So.
I thought at this point the name Zoodler has just sort of like come to describe that thing that makes shavings of vegetables.
Yeah, the spiralizer.
Isn't that the thing that kids had where you put your little pen in the little thing with gears and you spin it around and it makes little fractal patterns or whatever?
It was a spirograph.
Spirograph,
Yeah.
that's what I meant.
Yeah, I had one of those. It was fun. No, but the spiralizer is not fun. Jason bought one that's over at his apartment, and we used it a couple times. And the design of that particular model leads to most of the zucchini going out of the storage bin it's supposed to be collected in, while you're still turning the little crank thing, so then you just wind up with zucchini all over your counter. It's
So,
not.
aren't you supposed to just like do it over a bowl or a cutting board or something? I didn't think they had like little catchers.
This one has a catcher. It just doesn't work.
We have a cheese grater that's got a catcher too, that if you grate too much cheese and then like take the top off, it just spills everywhere.
This is not that situation because it just sort of immediately comes out of the thing while you're using it. But the we have collectively decided that it is not worth time nor effort, versus just going to the grocery store and getting the pre-spiralized vegetables. Because then,
Pre-spiralized vegetables. First of all, what a privilege you
I
had
know.
to be able to purchase such a thing.
It's like I have a butler making croissants in a oven for me every
He
morning.
was just heating the croissants, to be honest. I don't think he
Yeah.
was actually making them.
No, I don't think they had the technology back then.
I think croissants are difficult to make, aren't they?
Very, because it's a laminated dough, meaning that there's layers of butter in between
Right,
layers of
because you got to
dough.
get that you got to get the air pockets in there and the fluffiness.
Yeah, and the air pockets come from the steam from the butter when it heats up. So there you
It's
go.
like a popover, kind of.
You're a popover. It was the same principle because it's pastry dough. There are different kinds of pastry doughs. Like the Danish pastry doughs tend to be richer because they have egg in them and stuff. But whatever. You can buy those frozen croissants these days from like different vendors, and then you just pop them into your toaster oven. But you have to like leave them out overnight to defrost. Like even Trader Joe's has them.
Frozen uncooked or frozen cooked?
I think they're like par cooked or something. I don't know, but they're frozen croissant shaped things. You just take them out and you leave them on the counter overnight. then they're defrost overnight, and then you put it in the oven. And you can't microwave defrost it. You have to do it that way.
Mm.
And because most of the time people are buying their pastry dough either frozen or refrigerated because it's a pain in the butt to make it. Mm-hmm. So why bother? And then they have these products which take it even a step further, and you just have the thing. But
I gotta tell you, I like a croissant. I very much enjoy a croissant.
I like croissants too. I'm picky though. I would say that when I was a young person who had not had many croissants, the idea of a grocery store croissant sounded exciting because it was, you know, more interesting than a Pillsbury Grands biscuit. But
I'm talking about the ones that they put in like the generic plastic box thing with like a $6 sticker on it, like they make at the bakery there and then sell for like a week straight out on the little table there.
Oh yeah, the super stale ones. So those, like I thought those were, that was fancy. And then I moved to a real city and I had real croissants and I was like, oh, now I can't go back. Because a real, you know, croissant from a bakery versus like a grocery store thing or one of those terribly sad things that they sell you at Starbucks. And then they're like, you want us to heat it up for you? And it's like, no, it's not going to do anything. It's not going to make anything better. It's one of those scenarios where, I don't bother in those things.
Mm. Mm-hmm. You know, where I get the vast majority of my slightly mediocre, croissants.
I'm going to guess Safeway.
Starbucks.
Yeah, you know, I don't like those. Like
they're
I just
more
said.
Edible than Safeway, is what I'll say. They're small.
I suppose. It would take me like five more minutes to go to a slightly better place to get a croissant than to go to the Starbucks near me.
I hear driving around in Los Angeles is very difficult, though.
It's very difficult, especially when you're going to go get coffee on the other side of town. But I just happen to live in an area where I have access to croissants because I am apparently Dan Aykroyd, which is not a comforting thought.
Well, at least you're this Dan Aykroyd, which kind of sort of seemed like he had his stuff together. But this movie, can we visually pivot to the movie now?
Yeah.
Trading Places?
I think that this is time to start the condemnation. So get the ball rolling.
So I would like to start off with a statement that I think will set the tone for the rest of the conversation. This movie is Animal House on Wall Street in all of its forms. The music, Elmer Bernstein. I would not be surprised if the music is literally the same, but it sounds almost exactly the same as Animal House. Directorially, it is shot and directed almost exactly like Animal House, and you got a lot of Animal Housey type things. And, you know, obviously the other major thing that the two have in common is, of course, John Landis. But I feel like
he's the father of Max Landis. Did you know that?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that fact. That factoid there. But I feel like he diverged a little bit on Blues Brothers. But this is a return to form, I guess.
Is complimentary, I suppose.
No, it's, I mean, you know, so the difficulty I have, again, and I'm not going to like try and defend Animal House any further, but I feel like Animal House was the movie I would rather watch over this movie if I was choosing between the two John Landis properties. Because, I mean, probably the other factor in this situation is that none of this is fun in 2017 to watch, really, at all, in any shape or form.
Yeah, I think I've seen parts of this movie over the years on cable television, but
you know,
never.
It's another one where there's like small gifs and lines or whatever that people pull out and use fairly often. You know, looking good, Lewis, feeling good, Todd, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Billy Ray.
At the end there. So, less so probably. So if you've seen bits, you've probably seen the eating of the smoked salmon through the beard.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
And then, gosh, what else? I don't know.
I couldn't tell if it was smoked salmon or if it was just overcooked salmon.
Well, it was on a buffet table at a fancy party, so I assumed it was just smoked salmon.
Yeah, but it was the 80s, so I just assume it's overcooked.
Mm.
But But yeah, there's lots of little bits and pieces, and this movie is also somewhat notorious for a Jamie Lee Curtis topless moment, as well as a lot of other topless moments from other actresses. So you've definitely would have come across something about this movie. It is also a movie that was well reviewed at the time. 3.5 stars from Roger Ebert out of 4. People loved it. People loved the movie.
You know, it's a story that I think people can enjoy watching because the sadistic, rich old white folks really get it in the end. They tried to ruin a perfectly nice, stuck up rich white young guy and confuse and bewilder a nice young black man, and then they get their comeuppance in the end, and they go broke and yeah. stuff.
Well,
but
it's also got the heavier notion of nature versus nurture in here, which and I say heavy because it's heavy handed and ham fisted.
Right,
there's no nuance.
you could almost like find somewhere in this movie to cut in that scene from Django Unchained where DiCaprio was sawing that skull open and giving his little soliloquy, and it would probably fit relatively well.
Ugh. Yeah. So while I can look favorably upon some of the things that the movie was trying to do, well,
there's a little bit of clever writing here and there and some funny lines, and then there's some... Oh, look at the humorous moments, and you've got, you know, the misunderstandings amongst people, and look how funny it is that we have all of this ingrained bias towards this classism and racism and stuff with the bumping into him and knocking him down, and oh, he's trying to rob me, send him to jail, like all of these horrible things, which are just a big misunderstanding. And imagine if that misunderstanding went the other direction for once, and then how would that go? Turns out still not really great.
No, so. And there's a lot of stuff in here which is not particularly evolved to go along with, I think, the movie's central theme of, you know, there is nothing inherently wrong with Eddie Murphy's character that would prevent him from being as successful as Dan Aykroyd. When you move past that, you still have other things like the sexism and the homophobia and all kinds of other goodies to sort through.
Yeah, and even if you were trying to look past that, like what is the moral here with like 2 weeks of studying commodities markets and a decent amount of capital and stealing some government secrets before some other people can steal some government secrets, you can put some bad people out of business and then make a bunch of money in the same time. Like, I'm not entirely certain that the quote-unquote good guys in this movie really come down on the side of morality, especially given that they... I mean, sure, Beaks was a bad guy, but they duct-taped him inside of a gorilla suit and let him get abused by a gorilla.
Yeah. A male gorilla. Ha ha ha.
Isn't that funny? Because he's a bad person, and he's going to get a real bad thing.
Yes. So awful. I think that this, like I said, while this movie is trying to do some things and show that the down and out character, that Eddie Murphy portrays Valentine, that he is as capable as Dan Aykroyd's character Winthorpe. While they try to do that, they get to a point at the end where everything has to come back together, and it isn't plausible how they become best friends.
Oh, sure, that's the other thing too. The third act of this movie really spins into like the third act of Animal House is probably another reason that is equivalent, because the end of Animal House is just like, and now there's chaos at the parade, and there's all kinds of antics and silliness. And then this movie's version is you've got the New Year's Eve party on the train with Jim Belushi and other things. And then they there's a lot of shouting on the New York Stock Exchange floor, and then suddenly they're rich.
Yeah, I will say this. I have no more of a clue about how the stock exchange works at the end of this movie than I did at the beginning of this movie. So, and if anything, I only have more questions.
I was thinking about that in terms of what they actually did. So they, you would think they would have written it so they would have walked away with like cash, like, you know, they started buying when the market opened and then sold later. But what they did is they sold immediately and then they bought back later. So basically they own a lot of the commodities, but they don't, they're not like, they don't have cash. They have orange juice, right?
Well, but they can sell those shares.
Yeah. I mean, later.
Yeah. Which presumably they did in order to afford the lifestyle that they are depicted as having.
Sure, but they're not going to sell it until it goes back up again, which is it going to go back up? Like, what? It doesn't. Why did they write it that way? Why didn't they write it so they just, like, bought a bunch and then sold it again? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, no. But we don't know how much time has elapsed between one moment and the other. Also,
yeah, but like it could have been like, you know, done, end of story. Like, we have the money now, but instead there's like, well, okay, they bought it all now, and now they have to go do stuff.
Yeah, but they have a lot of things that are still worth money. So, I'm fine with that. It's just the part where they're just like shouting, and there's no sense of geography. And there's people just running across the floor. Yeah, and it's just like, okay, it's
the last bastion of true capitalism or whatever.
Yeah. And they have the old guys up in the skybox, looking at the floor. And this was back before everything was all computerized. So people are literally yelling and writing things on paper slips that they're handing to one another. So that's a thing. But
nowadays you could just do it with an app. You could have this whole movie with, the Ameritrade app or something. I don't know what app people are using to trade commodities and stocks. I assume there's something dumb.
I'm pretty sure that they would do it with a bunch of monitors in a room and some green text that scrolls by and somebody shouting about how the number's going up or down or something. And then ta-da, the end. But another thing that I don't like about the end of this movie that is perhaps more ridiculous and unbelievable than the things that you were objecting to is that Eddie Murphy is wearing a sweater on
the beach.
What? that is unexplained. Also he has a woman companion with him, who came from nowhere. She's just materialized out of thin air, because of course Dan Aykroyd has developed a relationship with Ophelia, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, and so therefore he needs to also have a romantic partner. However, yeah. Coleman is also there, and he has no one. So I don't understand that.
Coleman's self-sufficient. He's got. No, he's talking to a lady. She may not be his special lady friend, but he has a lady that he's talking to about lobster or crab. But yeah. I think the lady laying next to Eddie Murphy might have been one of the ladies from the party where he suddenly turned from, like, let's have a party to you're ruining my Persian rug.
And that party scene was interesting, but we don't really, like he says, none of them were really his friends. He basically just wanted to impress everybody, and then he got fed up with it when he realized that he was just being taken advantage of, because nobody really cared about his stuff, and it was his stuff.
Pretty quick turn too from the previous scene where he was kind of like not really buying that the stuff was his.
Right. It also goes nowhere with the two jail cell guys who had been tagging along. I don't know why, but they were there at the party as well, and they get shooed off. But he all of a sudden he just gets very sad because he realizes nobody really likes him for who he is. They just want to mess up his Persian rug. I don't know why. It would probably make more sense over a longer period of time, or if we knew any of those characters or any of those characters came back or recurred through the rest of the film. Because he just sort of has a very sudden pivot, where he goes from the Valentine that you know at the beginning of the movie to the sort of businessy Valentine that you see for the rest of the film.
Politics is money and opportunity for him to realize that he needs to stop wasting his time with all of these freeloaders and get to buckling down and studying economics, I guess. Because like the first theory he pitches about like why people are buying and or selling on Christmas or whatever is not really rooted in the commodity itself, but in like human behavior. So he's kind of just trying to analyze when and where and how people are going to start selling whatever it is that they were selling that particular day.
Yeah, and this is similar to the way that Dan Aykroyd had a intuition about what he thought would happen, rather than any sort of researched knowledge. So they are similar in that way, and coincidentally, it's pork belly both times. Right. one of the old guys explains what pork bellies are used for, which is bacon. And then you could find a bacon in a BLT sandwich, a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. And then Eddie Murphy looks at the camera and breaks the fourth wall.
I feel like there was I don't know if you caught it, there was another fourth wall break when he was in the back of the cop car or something. But they cut to him so quickly that he's like looking at the camera, but they cut to him like right as the car is driving away. So it seems like there was something else there that maybe got cut out or something.
Perhaps.
And I think there was one other fourth wall break at some other point too, but I can't remember.
It's a thing he likes to do. But as you know from the Beverly Hills Cop franchise.
Also in Animal House, it occurs as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these are definitely, you know, nothing about this is reality. So you can play with that fourth wall breaking as much as you want.
And I'm conflicted about this movie, you know, not in the same way as Animal House, but in sort of a similar feeling internally, because this is another one of those movies that you see a lot on TV or whatever, and it's a fun, silly movie in parts, and at the same time, I don't know, maybe it's just, you know, the modern era rewatching it, or just watching it at a distance now, that it's just like, it's got this sheen of like, oh, this doesn't hold up, and for the wrong reason now. Like, I don't feel good about a lot of these things, which kind of takes away from the things I did feel good about.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to entirely crap all over this movie. Like, I want to give it credit for being like a silly, kind of funny, like sort of interesting concept. But then a lot of it is just kind of, I don't want to say problematic because I say it too much.
Hey, Dan. Dan, mm-hmm. You know what this movie is?
Yeah.
Problematic.
It's problematic at times. Yeah,
trading problematics. No, but the thing with this is that it has so many of those other aspects that it doesn't really come close to addressing, whereas it tries sort of with race and the inequality that people are dealt, like, you know, Winthorpe comes from a background where he has money, and so he gets to go do these things, and he gets to be friends with Todd and play squash, and that's not the background that Eddie Murphy's character has. And
also down to the point that, like, what's her name, Penelope? He's gonna marry Penelope because basically it means if you're rich, you get to marry an equally nice rich woman or something. Like, people don't marry for love. It's just a matter of whether or not you have stuff.
Well, it certainly seems that way from Penelope's point of view. We see her later at the club, and she's already close friends with Todd.
Well, there's an established battle between Lewis and Todd from the very beginning. But yes, it is, she does very quickly run back into the arms of the world she knows, rather than trying to like focus on the man she's in a relationship with. Just from the very beginning of like trying to pick him up at the jail, she's embarrassed and ashamed that she had to come all the way down there.
Yeah, and one of the more interesting affectations is every time they talk about the drug that he was accused of dealing, he corrects them.
It was not heroin, it was PCP, angel dust, and I've never seen that before in my life. Like, again, that's one of the things that I'd want to give them credit for, because there is some humorous writing at times, that kind of stuff. But, yeah, again, like, you know, like these characters, first of all, they're not supposed to be likable, but they're like, they're so unlikable. Like, these are the people that would like literally deny that human beings poop or something. Like, no, how dare, how embarrassing would you, would, is it to say that we use the restroom that is below us and for the common folk? It's like, these people are cartoons and then like satire. I mean, they're National Lampoon characters is what they are. This isn't a National Lampoon movie, is it?
No, it's not.
It may as well be. I mean, like, if this... The only thing separating this from a National Lampoon movie is the fact that these are adults instead of college kids.
Yeah. And...
you know what I just realized? National Lampoon's Trading Places is basically like if John Landis directed The Social Network.
Ew.
Yeah.
I don't think I wanted to see that.
No, probably not.
No. But with this one, with this movie... You also get the added awkwardness of Jamie Lee Curtis's character, who takes pity upon Lewis, and basically that is what allows him to keep going through the rest of the movie. Otherwise, he would just, I don't know, be dead in a ditch somewhere.
Well, I mean, he tried to kill himself even with her help, but like, her character is supposed to kind of be the antithesis to him and sort of like show him what the other side is like. You know, she's a hustler or whatever. She does what she has to do. But the character, you know, she's a shrewd businesswoman in her own way because she's prostituting only as long as she has to save up enough money so she can retire on because she's got this all figured out. But like, that's, is the movie trying to tell us that that's like what, making lemonade out of lemons, being a prostitute? I'm not entirely certain about that.
It's sometimes in movies there is that trope of the you'll pardon my language, but this is literally what everyone calls it, the hooker with the heart of gold. That is not the appropriate nomenclature, that is definitely the trope where you see a character who is a person who takes money for sex, and then they only do that because they really, really have to, and that once they can get out, they'll be getting out of there and they'll be free, and then they help whoever the protagonist is. And I don't know. I think it's one way for the audience to like feel better about liking her. Because I don't know if they're just worried that people wouldn't like it if she was just like, yeah, no, this is how things are. I'm happy about everything.
She's pretty much like, this is how things are. Like, all I was ever given in this world is my body and my face, and I'm going to use that as best I can. It's like, are you trying to paint a picture of the world in this movie that times are so economically tight that you literally just have to, like, sell your organs or something, like, to make it by? I don't know. Like, you're either begging on the street or prostituting, or you're running the commodities trading place. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong, we're probably headed towards this sort of economic disparity eventually, but, like, in this movie, I don't think that that's really the situation. It's not the 1983 that I remember. I don't remember 1983 because I wasn't born yet.
I mean, I was born, but like, I was less than 6 months old when this movie premiered. So, not the movie, not the era that I remember. Also, I had nothing to do with Philadelphia or New York in that era. But
interesting, interesting choosing Philadelphia for the location for this. I'm not quite certain why that is.
I'm assuming it was cheaper to film in Philadelphia than in New York.
But they go to New York, and there's a nice shot of the Twin Towers there where they get out of the cab. I'm not quite sure how close that is to whichever exchange floor commodities are traded, but, you know, it's a set piece thing.
Yeah, World Trade Center. So, great. I just don't know where to go from here, because everything's just like a bunch of jokes, so it's hard to break it all down, and we've already basically summarized the entire movie.
Is this your first time seeing this movie?
I think this is definitely my first time seeing it entirely to completion.
All right. Yeah. Don't use that terminology.
To completion?
Yeah.
Why?
I think that's an industry term for Jamie Lee Curtis's industry.
Oh, Dan.
Yeah.
Dan.
I'm just warning you.
You're being very problematic right now. That's all I'm going
to
say.
I'm just trying to make you aware of the things that you're saying.
Uh-huh.
It's all about education. If you're educated enough, you can accomplish anything.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And you can be educated in less than a week.
Yeah, and the other thing about it is, they kind of hint at it, but I think there's a line almost directly addressing it as well, where they say they've done this before to someone else, apparently.
Well, it was unclear exactly what it was. It seems like they like to have bets, but I don't know if there's like a prequel movie in here where this went the other way.
Mm. Yeah, I thought there was a line or something about wouldn't be the first time, or we've done this before, but there were different stakes this time because I don't know, maybe because they were trying to make Dan Aykroyd turn to the life of crime, because that was like the secondary bit here.
Yeah, that was also part of the condition of this from the Duke brothers. Which Mortimer reminds Randolph about when it's pretty obvious that things have gone a certain way in terms of Valentine. Because Mortimer tries to leave like his wallet in the office, and Valentine runs it down and then hands it off to the Duke brothers, and is very emphatic that he didn't take anything from there. And that was because Mortimer left it there on purpose to try to entice some criminal element to occur. Because he's a jerk.
Maybe that's another one of the reasons that I have a little bit of difficulty with this movie, is because I don't particularly enjoy, I don't know, any sort of movie, TV show, whatever, where it's just like, look at all of these fun ways that we can crap all over somebody and make their life miserable. Like, obviously it's fake or whatever, but like, I don't enjoy
fake or whatever.
Right. I mean, it's not like I don't actually feel bad for this character because I know it's just a movie and I know this character is going to come out of this, but it's like, I don't enjoy watching people's lives being ruined, I guess maybe would be a way to say it. Like, that's not like a genre of things that appeal to me.
Yeah. But, I actually have an interesting question now that you raise that. Do you actually find yourself rooting for Dan Aykroyd at any point in this film?
I'll give him like a solid like 5% rooting for. I'm rooting for him to gain self-awareness and use the means that he has that have not been given to him to accomplish something. In the same way that, you know, kind of Eddie Murphy, too. Like, you want them to stand on their own two feet and do something rather than just, like, follow along as pawns, whether it be the pawn that of Dan Aykroyd getting crapped all over, or the pawn of Eddie Murphy just sort of playing along and running the brokership or whatever. But, like, I don't care if he becomes a successful millionaire or whatever with his little yacht in Hawaii, wherever that was. Like, honestly, you know, if there was a fourth act of this movie, it's probably just them going on to become horrible tyrannical people like the Dukes, maybe slightly less so, because I don't know, like nothing in this movie makes me think that Dan Aykroyd is going to get all his money back and then like suddenly, you know, turn over a new leaf because he's dating what's her name, I already forgot her name. Jamie Lee Curtis.
Like, Ophelia.
I don't think she's really going to, like, be the voice of reason for him. I think at some point he's just going to, like, be that guy who stops acknowledging people and, like, look at all the money I have. I'm going to go do whatever I feel like doing.
Well, it's open to interpretation, but I definitely view it more as you have described that situation, because we don't really see him develop in a way that makes him regret or have remorse a lot for his prior behavior, nor do we see much of his life after the events of this film.
He appears to be somebody who's only comforted by money and possessions.
Yes.
Except very briefly by Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yes. And so maybe he's in a good mood now that he has stuff again at the end of the thing, but it's not clear to me that his character has been significantly transformed by the experience, where other than he seems to not be concerned with spending time with Valentine and Coleman and Ophelia, whereas at the beginning of the movie he would have recoiled at the notion of any of that.
Right, these are his real friends that'll actually go to bat for him when he's in trouble, as opposed to his club friends who'll just sing in a delightful harmony and tell him to leave because he's an embarrassment.
Yeah, but we just can intuit that because they're hanging out with him.
Right.
Like, so that must mean that must have occurred. But
but again, the thing I keep coming back to is, like, the moral of this movie is, like, two wrongs do make a right, or, I don't know, like, eight wrongs make a right or something? I don't even know how to describe it.
Basically, this movie relies on you despising the Duke brothers.
Sure, easy to do. They're racists.
yes.
And they're bad people.
Yeah, and they also are doing something illegal.
Sure, there's that too.
Yeah, like, not just what they do to Dan Aykroyd, which is illegal, but what they
Well, I mean, they try to set it up in a way where it's just like he's living in their house with their, like, stuff, and their Coleman works for them, so they're like, they're just taking away things that they own.
Yeah, except for the part where they have frozen his bank account and done all the stuff with the IRS because of the drug stuff. Like, they're manipulating things in a way to take away all of his stuff on purpose. So that's not legal. And also planting the drugs, which they get Clarence Beeks to do when he talks to the cop. So that's basically how everything spirals out of control. And so framing somebody is illegal. And then there's the other illegal stuff that they go on to do to everyone else, where they're trying to profit off of information that's been illicitly obtained by Clarence Beeks, where they'll get the crop report early before anybody else. And then they can do some insider trading. That's basically what makes you, like, really, like, want to see these guys fail. You want to see.
It's also weird because it's like there's very much like a greed is bad message, because, like, clearly they're still making lots of money, and yet they're going to all of these other lengths to break the law and do horrible things to people for amusement and make more money. Like, they're not cool with just making the millions. They want to make lots of more millions by doing things illegal. So, but, like, that's even, like, the greed, the financial greed, is, like, fifth on the list of reasons to hate them in this movie.
Well, and there are, in addition to the greed of wanting to make more, they're also miserly. As you see from the earlier scenes in the film, where they hand a $5 bill, Randolph hands a $5 bill to Ezra, the guy who brought them their drinks, and he says, oh, maybe I'll go see a movie by myself. And then Mortimer reminds him that half of that $5 was from him, so Merry Christmas. And then you get more of that with the check signing, and, like, why are these checks so big, and we're paying an awful lot of money to all these people. So they're...
Can't get around that minimum wage, ha ha ha.
Yuppies. He's both of the Duke brothers are definitely reluctant to spend money on the people around them. They don't really care. And even the bet that they make with one another is over a single dollar bill. It's mainly just this sort of weird, old fashioned notion of just messing with people because you have the power to, which drives the bet, not so much the money that they're exchanging. Yay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, how many silly things can we do to make these guys seem horrible, and how many horrible, silly things can we do to these characters to put them down on their luck? And then what sort of silly, convoluted plan can we use to make them rich and get the bad guys, you know, get rich and put them in the, put them, make them, what does he say? put them in the doghouse.
That's a poorhouse.
Poorhouse, all at the same time. Yeah, there you go. The poorhouse. That's a thing, right? The big house where all the poor people go.
I don't think that's a thing any longer. But it's a phrase. It's an expression. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about exactly where things went with that.
You know, again, like in 1983, this is probably just a silly, fun, oh, that's an interesting kind of idea, fun movie for the people who like the John Landis-y things. But, you know, I feel like this movie is not super well suited for the modern era, particularly in light of the past year, just because, you know.
Oh, yeah.
No, hey, we're rich old white guys. Let's screw some poor people. Like, that's not a message we need more of right now.
Yeah, but I would say that you could watch, theoretically, you could watch a movie that features something like that, and you could be like, boo, the rich guys. But you watch this, and you're also like, oh, Dan Aykroyd, I don't think you should be saying that. No, Eddie Murphy, don't call that lady a B word. It's that sort of stuff that's also kind of baggage that this movie has to try to bring to the modern era, and I don't know that it successfully does it. If you were not previously a fan of this film, I'm not sure that you could just watch this movie for the first time ever in 2017 and just be like, yeah, yay, hilarious, LOL, I agree with everything that's going on. Curiously, on the Wikipedia page, in Italy, the movie has become a Christmas classic, being broadcast by Italian television every year from December 24th, 1997. So,
yeah, you brought that up because you were looking through the list of Christmas movies. If people haven't figured out by now, we do Christmassy things around Christmas time, and you're like, Trading Places? Christmas movies? Like, well, it's snowing, and then there's that scene where he's dressed like Santa eating the fish
at the Christmas party,
drunk and homeless.
Yeah.
But I mean,
Christmas and New Year's play a part,
right?
Sort of.
So this it takes us all the way through the new year.
Mm-hmm. It's just when his what was it? His wedding was supposed to not the wedding, but they were supposed to go away on something that was supposed to be on the second. And she's like, "Oh, that's the crew up report."
Oh, right. It was his. It was her aunt's party or something.
Yeah. So anyway, this is an '80s movie. Ta-da. And while it has a message about bad things that white guys do, it also has a message about a lot of bad things that other people still do and did in the movie. So, yay. Problematic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if this is even a weird question to ask. Like, is it? I've pointed out that there are a lot of these pieces that I don't particularly enjoy, like the watching people be tortured and stuff. That's not necessarily like an era specific thing, but like, I don't know. I almost feel like maybe it's just the part of my brain from 2017, but I feel like I shouldn't even be allowed to try and enjoy this movie. I should, I don't know, try and pick apart all of the things that are bad about it. I don't know if that's just my nature as like the person who's watching this movie for the sake of talking about it on this show, but like, should people be able to, like, you know, because there are certain movies you can watch that are dumb things where you can just turn off your brain and watch it, but I feel like this is not a thing where you should be allowed to like turn off your brain and watch it.
Yeah, I don't think you can turn off your brain and watch this movie. But at the same time,
I feel like it leads to more types of bad people that we don't need in the world.
I would agree with that. I think your instincts are correct. You don't have to necessarily hate every waking moment of the film. I think there are.
I certainly don't. I would like to stipulate again. I certainly don't. But like, the reason
I hope
keep
you don't.
Back,
you recommended we do this movie this
well,
week.
Again, you know, I had forgotten a lot of it too, and you know, I don't hate every bit of it, but it, you know, the reason I keep bringing it up is because obviously I haven't seen this in a very long time, and these are the feelings about the movie that are new to me. So, you know, trying to feel these out and, I don't know, get my head around like what I'm supposed to feel when I watch a movie from the early 80s made by John Landis. It's like, well, a lot of problems with that stuff now, but, you know, in general, like, you know, he gets a lot of goodwill from me personally for like Blues Brothers because I really like Blues Brothers, and I hope to God I don't ever have these sort of horrible conflicted feelings about Blues Brothers, but, you know, it's probably also a difficult movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen all of Blues Brothers. I will be perfectly honest with you. There are a lot of comedies from the 70s and the 80s that I have not seen in its in their entirety. Remember when we watched Caddyshack?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's usually because I'm like, I've seen it like bits and pieces on TV, and it's like, it's kind of a weird thing, and I don't really need to go revisit that. And then I watch it, and I'm just like, yep, that confirmed all that.
You don't find any enjoyment in Blues Brothers?
Well, I haven't seen it.
I thought you said you saw parts of it.
No. What I was referring to was Caddyshack. Like when I said that I saw parts of that, and then watched it, and I was like, yep, confirmed. But I will say there's some positive performances in this movie. Like I like Eddie Murphy's acting ability here. You see some of that. This is early Eddie Murphy, 1983.
Mm-hmm. It's good.
Yeah, and you get I wouldn't say I like Dan Aykroyd, but he's perfectly capable of being a yuppie. Jamie Lee Curtis is fun. Paul Gleason as Clarence Beeks. He's always interesting to see. He was in another mm-hmm. Christmas movie we did, Die Hard.
That's right.
And there's Denholm Elliott, which is he's fun because he's Marcus Brody from Indiana Jones.
Yeah, he always plays sort of a lovable, inept kind of doofusy character.
Yeah, I wonder if he plays other characters that aren't as inept and doofusy, and it's just that we see him play those roles in the American movies.
He just kind of has a befuddled face.
Yeah, he seems befuddled. I would say that's appropriate.
A nice long word for the rich folks to use.
Yeah, speaking of the rich folks, I do like the Duke brothers in terms of them portraying these awful human beings that they are. That is good on the part of Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy. But
oh, yeah, also, how creepy is it that they still live together at their age?
Very creepy.
At the they're beginning brothers, of this movie, apparently, but, you know.
When, at the beginning of this movie, when they're walking down the stairwell that has the double stairwell that mm-hmm. joins together, and they have their matching servants on either side of the stairwell, it's very peculiar. And then they ride together to work, and it's just like, initially I was like, wait, are these the brothers, or is one of them... Interesting. And then so they of course are the brothers, but it's a weird way to live, that's for sure.
You know what I found myself wondering when I saw some of these scenes in the beginning there, partly with Winthorpe, but mostly once they got to the Dukes, was like, now was there a document in the contract, like a separate page stapled to the back, that when all of these employees got these jobs, that it said you will complete these tasks on a daily basis. You will say, hello, Mr. Duke. You will smile, you will wave and nod like as I am on my way to the car. And I may or may not reply to you or address you or look you in the eye or anything of the sort, but it is your legal obligation to be polite to me and address me every morning. Like, do you think that was ahead of time thing, or is that just like a... That's like the unspoken rule of the Duke household, that you got to do that kind of thing to keep the job.
Oh, I'm sure it's all unspoken and passed down from attendant and servant to the next, because they seem to come from a background in which they have a long and storied history of being horribly rich. So, you know,
right, because
that.
A Duke has been sitting on the whatever since it was founded.
The stock exchange.
Yeah. And it belongs to them.
Yeah. I like when his brother has the heart attack and then he's shouting at him.
I also like that, since obviously we're not watching the TV edited version of this, he says, F him after he falls down and he's having a heart attack.
Yeah. Apparently, Don Ameche, because he's such an old school actor, went around the set and apologized to everyone that he would be cursing that day before he did it, according to a story from Jamie Lee Curtis. So,
I believe that. I mean, you know, he's an old school fella, and you want to make sure the crew realizes that it's all part of the show, folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's in the show is in the show. Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
What?
I'm trying to think of what else to really dive into in this. I mean, there's, I feel like there's so much wrong with that train scene too that I almost even don't even know where to start with it. Like, and is the are there New Year's Eve parties on trains? Is that a thing? Wait, why are people dressed in costumes on New Year's Eve too?
I don't know. I think it is specifically for the effect that you are going to wind up with afterwards. Chekhov's gorilla costume.
Well, yeah, Chekhov's law of Jim Belushi or something. Like, why?
Yeah. Why is Jim Belushi in this movie?
Because his brother was really good 2 years earlier in Blues Brothers.
Yeah,
but he got a speaking role out. He gets residuals from the fact that we watched this movie.
Oh,
we
dear.
Just gave Jim Belushi money.
I feel dirty.
Oh God, the inside of that gorilla suit probably dirty too.
Oh, hey, you want to hear something fun?
Maybe.
Timothy Harris and Herschel Weinrod, who wrote this, wrote a lot of stuff together. Like a lot of stuff.
What did they write?
Some real gems.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, Trading Places, then uh-huh. Brewster's Millions.
You know, oh God, we should watch Brewster's Millions because that's another one that fits squarely in with these movies that I remember, and there's some funny bits in it, but I can guarantee will be massively cringeworthy to watch again.
Yeah, not in a rush.
Have you seen Brewster's Millions?
No.
Are you familiar with the conceit?
I'm familiar with the conceit and with John Candy being cast and Richard Pryor in it. I'm sure it's amazing.
Well, but you know the part about it's the young white boy, obnoxious rich kid who buys a black man, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Continue on the list.
Yeah.
Of things
I don't like that. So I've never seen the movie. And then there's Twins that they wrote together with Arnold and Danny DeVito. And My Stepmother mm-hmm. is an Alien.
I don't know that movie.
Oh, that's a mess. It's a real mess. Dan Aykroyd is also in that one. And there is Kindergarten Cop, which is the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie with the little kids.
I enjoyed the Kindergarten Guy. It's interesting what you can see in their career where they kind of pivoted from like the comedians into the Arnold part.
And there's apparently a Martin Short and Danny Glover movie that I'd never heard of called Pure Luck that they did together. And it looks like the last credit they have together working on something is Space Jam.
Wow.
1996's Space Jam.
Wow.
Yeah. That's their fault.
Wait, there was a Kindergarten Cop 2?
Oh, I don't know anything about that.
Oh my God, Dolph Lundgren.
Oh, well, he's perfectly suited for that,
and
then.
And Bill Bellamy, what? What is this? Okay, I can't even look at that.
Mm-hmm. Don't fall down a rabbit hole of Kindergarten Cop sequels.
See, I remember Kindergarten Cop.
Mm-hmm.
That one wasn't problematic, was it?
I'm going to just bet it is, but
it probably is. Yeah, I mean, I haven't
seen it in a very long time. I always get it confused with Cop and a Half too, and I'm sure that one is also not good either.
Which one's Cop and a Half?
That's the one with what's his name? Smokey and the Bandit. The actor Reynolds.
Oh, Burt Reynolds, really?
Burt Reynolds, and he has a young kid that he is protecting because I think the kid is a witness in something. And then he's in Tampa because they agreed to give the movie money to film there so that they could employ people.
Oh, this is older Burt Reynolds where he's got that hair.
Yeah, and it was one of the times that Tampa was very excited that a movie was made there.
Tax credits. You get one, and then everyone's like, this is a huge hassle. Let's just shoot this in wherever the tax credits are better.
Yeah, well, they got another one, Thomas Jane's Punisher movie with John Travolta in it.
Right, you know, you get one every couple of decades, I guess.
Yeah, you get one shot at being the next Hollywood.
Boy, oh boy. Man. You know, I guess another reason that I'm kind of conflicted about this movie is this is... I mean, material aside, this is another one of those sort of like low budget to mid budget kind of comedy movies that you don't really see getting made anymore. And I'm sad that that genre is kind of gone. But at the same time, like, if these are our, you know, main examples of the genre, like, we need the genre needed to be updated anyway before it was going to die.
Yeah, it basically all fizzled out when the home video market dried up.
Because I feel like another one that I haven't seen in a very long time, but I feel like Van Wilder is kind of like the closest to a modern version of sort of a slapsticky, low-budget comedy, again, National Lampoon kind of stuff.
Well, it is National Lampoon.
Yeah, right. But like, also including, what's Tim Matheson? Is that the guy from Animal House? Anyway, but I feel like
Paul Gleason's in it too.
I feel like that movie is going to be very problematic. And, you know, when was that movie made? Like, mid-2000s?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean... 2002.
You know, even the stuff from when we were teens and stuff, like American Pie and its many sequels, it's like, yeah, that's none of that's good.
Yeah, that was... it's weird, though, looking back, because, like, those movies, you could look at them and go kind of like, oh, I kind of see how this kind of sort of represents my friend group or people I know from school. But like, at the same time, those movies presented such a dumbed down version of kids, where they're like, oh, they're so emotionally mature and they're dealing with all of these things and relationships. But they were all morons. Like, they yeah, were not socially conscious people. Maybe that's an internet thing, like, because this is all sort of like early internet, like the internet, we didn't have them in our pocket. Did the iPhone ruin this genre of movie? Is that what I'm trying to get at?
No.
Well, I mean, just widespread communication and I don't know, just like everyone seems so dumb in these movies, and now I feel like you can't get away with making a movie where people are that dumb.
I would say that's probably true. And I don't necessarily miss this genre of movies. I would include other things that we've watched in here, like Caddyshack and what was the one with the it was Real Genius, and then also the Top Secret, mm-hmm. Just like that kind of stuff where it's like, here's a couple million dollars, go do something crazy in a field and come back, and then
see, but like my internal feeling of those movies, like I really like those movies, but then when you break them down, like, they, you know, they had to die. Like, there's reasons they died. I mean, you know, oh god, see, I was about to say Real Genius is the exception, but then again, you've got all of the ridiculous sexist stuff too, which they tried, yeah, to sort of sidestep with, like, oh, we're putting a hat on a hat with this here sexism, because the girl's smart, and then the other one is sassy back with the hammer and the nail with the thing, but it's still not, like,
no,
appropriate.
Not a, yeah, there is a lack of like evolved characters.
I mean, maybe the thing is like, is it acceptable to have a genre where people are still inappropriate?
It's acceptable to have a genre where people are inappropriate if it's about teaching those people not to be to push those people through it. Like, if you're having a bad guy in a movie, it's fine that the bad guy is murdering people because he's a bad guy.
Right, but, you know, yeah, we've treaded this line before. Like, I think the example that comes to mind is, like, we, you know, Jurassic World, where they were making fun of all of the sponsorships of the park, and then at the same time, the entire movie was co-branded with, like, Verizon and Mercedes or whatever. So it's like, oh, you're making fun of the thing, but you're also doing the thing. Like, you know, if you spend 2.5 acts showing a character just being inappropriate and horrible, and then at the end they're like, oh, I have a moral, I'm gonna be a good person now, like, you still spent most of a movie just like making people in the audience presumably laugh at horrible things. Is that really a thing that you can do anymore and get away with? Because, like, you know, it seems like the answer is mostly no, unless you do it in a very deft manner, which I don't really know anyone doing that kind of stuff, but
I would not trust John Landis with that.
Well, certainly not John Landis. I think John Landis's time for making these types of movies has passed, or I don't know, making any movies. I don't know if he's still making movies. But you know,
I watched that. You ever watch that thing with, it's like him and Terry Gilliam like wandering around London in the middle of the night?
I have watched that. Yeah, and I thought there was some interesting commentary between that too. And there was some like film industry chat that was amusing, but then at the same time you step back and you look at the things that they do and you're like, oh, you're giving people advice on how to be filmmakers, but then you're giving them advice on how to be this. So, yeah. And like, I, you know, I appreciate, you know, the problem, the thing I'm struggling with is like, you know, the outside the boxness, the free spiritedness or whatever, like the freedom to explore things that are pushing edges and that sort of stuff versus just like glorifying stuff that we've kind of agreed as a group of people is not a thing to do anymore. I guess, you know, we're not like advocating for like burning these movies, like striking them from the record. So the fact that they exist and people can go watch and be like, you know what, that was kind of fun. It's super dated and super inappropriate and racist, but like, I'm glad that it exists and we can watch it. We can see it as an example of a comedy from an era, but we're not going to do that anymore.
Glad is a strong word. I don't know if I'd use glad.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not sad for the film industry in terms of like the history of the film industry that John Landis movies exist. Like, I don't think the industry as a whole would be better off if he had never made any of these movies, because there are some bits in them that are fun and unique and interesting and funny, but then there's a lot of it that's just like, yeah, we can't do that anymore.
Well, not just that, not just you can't do that anymore, it's just that movies like this often raise things as inappropriate and then never address them in a way that makes you feel like, okay, great, good, you took care of that. Like, we didn't just leave that sexist comment just dangling there. You know, you have to sort of confront these things and make sure that you're communicating a point of view, that the things that these characters are doing are outlandish and wrong, and that that needs to be communicated to the audience. Not we're not just like laughing at the scenario because it plays on a tension, and then that tension is never really addressed in any way to make a statement. I would say that while you might talk about like the lack of that you see in film, in terms of comedy, one surprising place that you see it is, I would argue, in network television. Like The Good Place deals with a lot of very thorny, complicated issues around what is and is not appropriate, and it's basically in a comedy. So I would say a show like that handles things a little bit more smartly than a movie like this does.
I'm gonna have to watch that, aren't I?
I would recommend it. I think it's on.
I mean, lots of people have been recommending it. I just haven't like gotten to it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where there's a mechanic at play that takes place over the whole series. So while you might not necessarily get into the first couple episodes, once you start to figure out there's something going on, then it'll make more sense. I think it's on Netflix for free at the moment for the first season, but I haven't watched the second season yet. Everybody's like, oh, it's even better than the first or something, but I don't know. People are generally very wrong about those sorts of things, but it came from Matt Alexander, so I have to believe him.
Right. And you just made me think of something else. Maybe the other reason that this movie is kind of difficult for me, or in general, I guess, for other people as well, is that, you know, the movie is doing the thing where people are doing things, and it is commenting on the fact that the things that they are doing are bad, but it's commenting on, like, you know, the main plot things where you would expect them to comment, like, you know, hey, you probably shouldn't ruin these people's lives for fun, or you shouldn't just like talk down to all of these people or just think that you're better than all these people, because that's not really appropriate. But then, like, all of the other stuff, all of the other filler is just all of the slapsticky inappropriateness stuff, and all of that stuff just breezes by. So it's like they're not above commenting and saying like, this is good, this is bad, but then like all of the other stuff in between that fills in the gaps is stuff that is equally as problematic. And maybe, again, like, it's a sign of the times, like, you know, everything needs to be dealt with appropriately, not just like the main, like, you know, giant horrible stereotype bad guys or something.
Yeah, and I brought that up earlier when I was talking about the sexism and when Eddie Murphy calls a woman the B word, because it's at the very beginning of the film. He is pretending to be an amputee in a sort of wheeled cart thing, and he just starts grabbing her by the dress and pulling on her and propositioning her for sex and how they should get together, and once you've been with him, then you'll never want to go back. And that's messed up for a variety of reasons, because it's basically like ableist, like he's pretending to, you know, have a disability that he doesn't have, and then trying to comment on that in that manner is really crass and disgusting. And then also, you shouldn't grab women and tell them you want to have sex with them. I feel like that's something else that you should not do. And then when they get away from you, you shouldn't also follow that up by calling them a profane word. I don't think that that's good. And yet that doesn't get addressed at any point in the film. He doesn't grow to respect women over the course of this. That particular incident doesn't go anywhere other than the officers just kind of wander over
to
him.
But they were gonna... a human being in general, so you must assume that he's grown in every capacity. No, I'm kidding. No, thank you for bringing that back up, because my brain completely glossed over that scene in the movie because there's so much other stuff in the movie to focus on.
Yeah, and there's also a couple of times where Eddie Murphy calls the Duke brothers a couple of some homophobic slurs. And that's not something that's addressed either. So the joke there is, of course, the homophobic slur. Like, that's funny that they would be called that. Whereas that's not the kind of joke writing that I necessarily think that you could do in 2017, unless you are, I don't know, on InfoWars or something. Like, I think that just does not pass in any sense. But it would be fine if you're saying or doing these bad things and then you follow it up by addressing that bad thing, like, oh, that was actually bad, I'm sorry, I'm gonna fix that. And not like in a Saturday, not like an after school special kind of a way, but just like even in the joke itself, you can address the thing that has happened. But they don't. The point of the joke is just that they did something bad. And so we laugh at them for doing the bad thing, but it's not, there is no story there that you're supposed to build on. And you're still supposed to like these characters ostensibly. So you should make them likable.
Honestly, the first instance where they're trying to lure him into the car after they bail him out, like my mind went into like an alternate version of this movie where, have you seen Get Out yet?
I haven't. Everybody says it's really good and I want to watch it, but
it's super good. You should totally watch it. It's super messed up.
But my brain went into video yet.
It is totally. Oh. I purchased it a while ago.
Okay.
My brain went into a situation like that movie where it's like, oh, these guys maybe have creepy alternative ideas of what's going on or what they're going to do with this guy, but not like in the slur that you're using there, fella, but like in a more like actual like terrifying way, like a la Get Out. You should go see that movie before you spoil it for you.
Okay. I promise. I'll go see Get Out and you watch The Good Place.
Okay. Good. We can call it a day and say ready, break, and we'll go do our things.
Mm-hmm.
You got like the last parting thoughts on that? No. All right.
Well, I mean, I guess it's a good thing I watched it finally, just for knowing what was in the movie, because a lot of times I can just kind of guess that I don't want to see something and then be wrong. But this is a case where I wasn't wrong, so I feel okay. It's good to have experienced it. Also, it definitely is a movie that makes me think of Christmassy themes with the sort of Dickensian stuff going on with people who are without money and rich people who are lording money over other people. So there you go.
You just need the ghost of frozen orange juice concentrate future to pop in and give them the crop report.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. It's good to see the movie again in its entirety, not on television, to make a more up to date assessment of it. But you know,
yeah. And I'm surprised, honestly, that they leave a lot of stuff in here. There's like a special edition. Some creative framing, like when we watched Animal House.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know how this movie appears when it runs on television, but you could easily extract the vast majority of that particular material to which you were referring.
Yeah. which is how you know it was really worth adding to the film. anyway, ta-da!
Trading places!
Traded. Ta-da.
Get it also because they trade commodities?
Yeah.